So I knew that in DOS you had to, I don't know, edit the config certs and auto exec back to get more memory for your games you want to play. So I knew a little bit of command line. And then when Salesforce DX was announced, the CLI is a big part, or is one of the big tools we got for development. And so I got into the CLI, the Salesforce CLI, and I really love it right now. So I use it every day. I use it a couple of times on different jobs, also not only on Salesforce development, also for private things.
That is Christian Menzinger, a freelance Salesforce trainer, developer, and consultant over in Germany. I'm Josh Burke, a developer evangelist for Salesforce. And here on the Salesforce Developer Podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down with Christian to talk about his experiences with Salesforce DX, starting with a little bit of advice for people who might not be familiar with it.
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, Salesforce DX is not an all or nothing option. So you don't have to follow a certain path and have to adopt the CLI and have to adopt unlock packages and Scratchhawk everything. So I would always recommend look at your current development workflow and mark out what are your biggest pain points. And then you can start to think about, okay, if, for instance, a pain point is that I'm overriding one developer is overriding the changes from another developer, then you definitely should go for like source-driven development and adopting Scratchrox, for everyone has his own environment. But as I said, you don't have to start with unlock package at the very first beginning. You can just see each and every part of these tools and paradigms and best practices, what fits into your environment. It's also totally valuable to say, okay, we use source-driven development, we develop on a Scratchrog, but then we deploy to our UAT sandbox or to our full copy sandbox, and then we do change sets to deploy to production. That's totally fine. But when you, for instance, already use change sets, you could also use unlock packages, because nearly everything what you can do with change sets can be done with unlock packages. But it could be on the next evaluation step, for instance. And in my experience, most of the trickiest part is not technical things. It's more about getting everyone into the same mindset.
When Christian's talking about source-driven development, he's really talking about something of a major transition from org-centric development, where you have some kind of development org or sandbox, which is your source of truth, versus using a repo. And there's various tricks that you can do using Scratchworks to make development easier.
So typically, you have one Scratchrog for one branch, and every developer works on a separate branch and has his own Scratchrog. So I worked at a company. I had a customer, and they used one developer org for all the developers, and it happened quite often that changes have been overwritten from one developer from changes from another developer. And this is, of course, the worst case. That's something you really want to avoid.
Yes.
And that's the reason why the Scratchrog is very tied to your source, what you're developing on. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to just compare two branches. For instance, you spin up two Scratchrogs and you see if you have the same behavior, or so maybe you have a user who can double check if there is changes, or if he makes an A and B test to say, okay, oh, this is much easier than that one. This is all about the strategy, about what you do in your code repository, how you branch your features, and then you can spin up a Scratchrog. You can automate this, of course, and just have someone testing your stuff, saying, okay, your product manager, for instance, your product owner, saying, okay, this is cool, or we go for that way, we go for this way.
And moving to a different portion of Salesforce DX, have you found tools like unlock packages to be useful when maintaining a large code base?
There are two things in your question. The one is unlock packages useful. Yes, definitely. The second one is in a large code base, which makes it tricky.
Gotcha. Give me a little bit of detail on that. What kind of experiences have you had?
Yeah, so I started with a customer, and so they had already some development going on, and we started kind of a greenfield side project. So we did not have a lot of dependency on the existing code base. And so we adopt unlock package for the new stuff. And that worked out very, very good. So we did not have a lot of dependencies. We just built the new stuff on top of the existing one. We create a package over there, reinstall the package. And we also started using unlock packages for the other projects, which have been already going on in the past. And so we had some interdependencies where we just moved into a base package. And so I think the default way how you could solve this is okay.
Yeah.
But it's getting complicated the larger the code base is going. So the problem is always if you have, for instance, if you're mixing different automation tools, process builders here, a workflow over there, then you have a trigger over there. And so you will have dependencies all over the place. And so the bigger the code base gets, the more separation you need. And so you want an unlock package. The idea is that you have like of separation of concern. You have one package which has a dedicated role in your system. But the problem is they all depend on, for instance, schema. They all depend on different other processes, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bigger and the more dependencies you have, the harder it's getting to untangle these dependencies. So that means it's not only unlock packages what you can adopt. So you also have to think about like maybe implementing like a dependency injection to untangle your dependencies or using enterprise patterns. So software architectural patterns to really separate different areas that you can easily use an unlock package. And there is also a gap. Unlock packages are fine, but not all metadata are yet supported. So there's a great,
right.
So there's a great metadata coverage report where you can see which metadata is supported for an unlock package.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the gaps are getting smaller with every release, but there is still some uncertainty that everything can be used in an unlock package when you have a bigger code base. And as I said, dependencies are a very crucial thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now with the summer release, with this release going on right now, you have this org-dependent unlock package, which is beta right now. So it's in a very early stage. But what this does is actually that you can say, okay, I'm only developing for my production org, but I have some dependencies I can't get rid of. I can't untangle it to separate packages. So I just need this dependency somehow resolved. And this is actually where org-dependent unlock packages come into the game. On the one hand side, this is great because now you can easily create this dependency package and then you can get your things done. But on the other hand, this is kind of saying, oh, we know that we have gaps and we know we cannot solve this API gaps quite fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so please use this org-dependent unlock package in the meantime because not everything can be untangled right now.
Right, right.
And as I said, unlock packages have been introduced 2 years ago, I think. And so
that sounds about right.
There are still some gaps, but I mean, that's okay. I mean, there is a lot of legacy code everywhere. So I think the same is true for Salesforce.
Yeah. So I think to kind of paraphrase that tip, well, at least part of that to a certain extent, is it sounds like some, you know, when you start getting into a larger code base like that, one way to remove some of the pain points of things like unlock packages and maintaining that code is to plan ahead, right? Because you're talking mm-hmm. about things like architectural patterns and separation of concerns. And that starts at the architectural level before, you know, how you're going to code the things, not actually the code itself.
Absolutely. And as I said, your bigger the code base gets and also your more legacy of code base you have, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I talk about code base, I not only mean Apex and maybe Lightning components, all that stuff. I mean your Salesforce.org, which is all kind of metadata, which is I'm talking about a code base.
Right.
And so, yeah, as I said, the larger it's going, the more trickier it gets. And one thing for sure, when you start in a smaller org and you start and maybe you're interested in Salesforce DX and best practice, so you definitely should adopt going for unlock packages because it gives you a way to structure your org from the beginning. What it does is actually, for instance, when you go to the setup and you have a look at the custom fields, if you have an unlock package and this field is part of an unlock package, you will see a yellow information that this field is part of package ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives an admin an idea. Oh, okay. So this field is part of project ABC. So maybe I'm talking with the product owner to get more information about this field or whatever you find in your org. So it just gives you a label to say, hey, I'm part of a separate package. And maybe you have a dedicated project owner for this package, it makes it easier when your org grows. So you have different separated labels, I would say, mm-hmm. to mark certain parts of your org to be part of a certain process or a certain package.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So not only on the design side of things, but because it's a distinct package, you have, I almost hesitate to use the word meta because we use it so much with Salesforce, but basically a meta layer of information about that functionality within an object itself.
Mm-hmm. And unlock packages are quite flexible. So they're really great. So for instance, you start small, you can iterate and you can undo everything. So that means mm-hmm. if you start with a package and you put, I don't know, everything into one package. And at a later point, you say, oh, I have a dependency to maybe another package. I need a base package. So you can just remove metadata from one package. And now it lives in a separate package. So you can move it around. You can remove things from one package. You put it into another one. So you're flexible. But it gives you the advantage that you have versioning. Mm-hmm. So you can really have dedicated package versions. You can roll back in your code base. You can create a new version with a you can create a hotfix, all that stuff. So it gives you just more control. It's not only like unstructured metadata all over your production org.
Right.
You just structure it back, and then you have full control about the lifecycle of this package.
Which is, you know, going back to the, shall we say, good old days, that's giving you the flexibility that unmanaged packages didn't have, but without all the weird restrictions that managed packages did.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's exactly. So you got the best of both worlds from unmanaged to managed package.
Nice.
So never use an unmanaged package if you really want to use it as a like deployment container and you want to iterate. Mm-hmm. Because with an unmanaged package, you have to uninstall and all your data, everything is lost when you have a new version of that unmanaged package. So this is really kind of something you don't want to have. On the other hand, if you build a managed package, you have a namespace and you have a lot of different restrictions you have to take care. This is also a burden in most cases. If you just build for your production org, you don't want to go there.
Right.
So unlock package is giving you really the flexibility. So you can remove things, you can upgrade things, you can install like a normal package, but you don't have to uninstall when you introduce a new package version.
Nice. So let's go back to the concept of DX and CLI as being kind of a very specific tool for solving problems. What are some pain points that you have resolved using Salesforce DX?
When you talk about Salesforce DX, mm-hmm. you have to specify what exactly do you mean?
Well, let's go back to the CLI.
Okay. Because in my opinion, Salesforce DX is just an umbrella term. It's kind mm-hmm. of not a product. It's kind of, it means so many things. And when you ask two people, you get maybe three opinions what Salesforce DX actually is.
Absolutely. Right?
And so when you say, okay, which complex things you can do with a CLI, mm-hmm. at least everything. Because if you have source code on your machine, you can transform the source code, you can modify it, you can use not only Salesforce commands, you can also use different commands which are from your operating system, for instance. Mm-hmm. And what I always do is I always have a create Scratchog script, because when I start a new project and you create a new Scratchog, you have always do several steps to establish your working environment.
Right.
You have to create a Scratchog, you have to push your source, you have to assign a permission set most likely, then you have to maybe import data, you have to maybe enable the debug mode if you do Lightning Web Components. There are little separate steps. And so this is actually a huge time saver. So I just chain all the commands in a bash script, and then whenever I need a new Scratchog or my manager needs a new Scratchog because he is interested in what's going on right now, I say, hey, no worries. I let the script run. I give you the credentials, log in and play around. You can't break anything. It's your org. Just do whatever you like. And so this is great power. And when you get deeper into what you can do with the Salesforce CLI, you can execute anonymous APEX. You can query using SQL queries. You can get the response as JSON. And there are great JSON libraries, for instance, JQ, that you can work with. So you can really, really fast working with data and with metadata, because it's all textual files. And with the CLI, you can modify text files very easily.
And so talking a little bit more about that flexibility, what is the role of plugins when utilizing the CLI?
There's a huge role. What I really love is there is a community around, and the CLI has a mechanism that you can create your own CLI plugin. So it has a built-in plugin creator. So you just say plugins create, and then it just starts a dialogue, and you can extend the existing CLI with your own. And this is really great because there are so many different aspects in the Salesforce development. Everyone has a different angle. If you're an ISV partner, if you're a customer, even if you take two ISV partners, they have maybe different requirements. And so with the power of the community, things can build, which Salesforce maybe don't have the focus on. I'll give you a good example. So a couple of days ago, I wanted to extend a little bit of existing code for a customer. And so I wanted to deploy this to my Scratch org, and it says, no, it's not working because of this and this error. So it pointed out that I need to enable shared activities. I had no clue about shared activities in the past. So I Googled a little bit and I found out, okay, shared activities is not exposed through the API. So there is no chance to make an automated build for a new Scratch org because I have to click this one button in the setup and say confirm.
Right.
There's no API for that. But then I found a plugin which is actually automating this step. So they're just using Google Puppeteer to say, okay, the button gets clicked for me and I can just chain, I can use this command in my build script. And now I have in full automation again for this certain behavior. And there is, it's just a small little piece,
right,
but saved me some time. And if you have a look at all the existing plugins, there are a couple of dozens around. And every plugin is solving more general purpose or very specific purpose or issues. And there is a great repository from Shane McLaughlin, which is also a Salesforce employee, because he has a awesome plugin repository, which is just a collection of all the different plugins from the community. So it's a huge list. It's a growing list.
Nice.
And this is one of the things which is a little bit sad is that there is no central marketplace like the AppExchange for Salesforce CLI plugins. So right now, you don't have that centralized repository where you can just say, hey, has someone else solved this issue?
Right.
So for now, this repository from Shane is quite good. And it, as I said, maintained. So also the community distributes some new plugins there. And it's definitely worth looking at the list because there are so many powerful things. For instance, if you have ever tried to convert a profile into a permission set, this is a really painful job. But there is a plugin for that, which exactly does this one, and it saves you a lot of time.
Nice. We will definitely link to Shane's repo in the show notes for anybody who's listening. And I also, that's the plugin you made an example of that's really kind of fascinating to me because you have a CLI plugin, which is manipulating a desktop browser. Like, that's pretty cool that there's that level of flexibility in the things that you can do using the CLI.
It's not only about the CLI, it's also about if you have the source code or the metadata code, I would say, on your machine. So just I give you another example, which is a very common task, but it can be achieved much easier in source code, in the XML files of the metadata rather than in the setup. So for instance, I don't know, you have a list, you have list views for your opportunities and someone introduces a new field. And you want to have to show up this field and all the, I don't know, 10 different list views. So you have to go to each and every list view, say edit, you have to add the field, you have to get save. But when you look at the metadata, it's just one note in an XML file. And I can easily copy and paste this one note into all the several places. And this job can be done in, I don't know, 30 seconds maybe.
Nice.
I just deploy back and the job is done. And maybe another tip on the side, whenever you start working with Salesforce metadata on your machine, be sure to use the source format. So the source format has also been introduced with Salesforce DX. And it's a different, how to say, it's different...
structure.
Structure, thank you. It's not that monolithic XML structure, so it breaks down into several XML files. And it's more handy, especially for version control, especially for... when human reads it and want to modify it, like adding a field to the list view. In the early days, when you have the metadata for an object, and then there's just one section for list views in that huge giant XML file, but with the source format, it's just one XML file for each and every list view. And so it's easy to maintain or adopt this requirement saying, hey, I want to add this field. And you can convert classical metadata into source format. So there's a command in the CLI, just convert it from one format into the other. So if you have already start working with source on your machine, mm-hmm. just convert it and put this into version control, which makes it much more easier.
That's our show. But now before we go, I did also want to ask Christian about his experiences of being a co-leader for the Munich user group, because we are, after all, recording in interesting times, which has shifted their strategy a bit.
Yeah, we had the same discussions at the beginning, we did not know how long this whole situation will rest. And mm-hmm. we thought, hey, maybe remote, just having like a webinar. We don't like this idea because we don't feel as a content provider, we really want to engage with the community. And so after a while, we said, okay, we will not go for normal meetups, in-person meetups quite early.
Yeah. And so,
okay, let's do a virtual meetup, but let's try to really engage the community. So what we did is we said, okay, please, everyone, turn on your webcam. We want to really engage also if someone is presenting. So in a classical webinar, you just post your question in the chat panel, and then it's getting read by one of the moderators and answered by the speaker. But we said, okay, just raise your hand. And so we use Zoom mm-hmm. because that's a feature that you can raise your hand. And so whenever someone raised a hand, we call him by name. And so he can unmute and he really can talk and interact with the presenter. And also after every talk, we have discussions. So we try to have free speech. Of course, a little bit of moderation, because if 10 people start talking at the same time,
right?
No, it is not working very good. But we found out that when we say, okay, please raise your hand or write into the chat panel and we will call you by name. And then we really had a good discussion. We also utilizing like polls to engage the people. We also try to make it a little bit more interactive.
Mm-hmm.
So I would highly recommend to really try to engage everyone. When you have a smaller group, it's easier, maybe 10 to 20 people. It's maybe okay that everyone just can start talking if someone has a question. But at a certain point, if you have too many people, you have to organize a little bit. What we did also is we had a slide at every meetup we do virtually now is giving you some tips about using Zoom, because everyone is used to it. So mm-hmm. like you put 49 different tiles on your screen. So if you have a second monitor, you can really see 49 people at a glance, which also gives you like more community feeling. If you not only see the speaker, you see all the known faces from in-person meetups. And so we gave some tips about, hey, don't be shy, turn on your webcam, use this setting in Zoom. We use this feature, raise your hand, all that stuff. And all together, I think we received very good feedback, and looking forward for the next one, I think in 2 weeks or so.
Finally, like so many people out there, Christian's favorite non-technical hobby includes entertaining the kids.
I have two boys, very, very active boys. So they also always want to be entertained. I mean, fortunately, not. They do really good also during this time, so they can really do a lot of things by their own. But it's always fun if we go somewhere, I don't know, for a hike in the Alps, or go for, I don't know, stand up paddle somewhere. So the kind of different things we do and be outside, be active. This is actually what I really love.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And thanks to Christian for the great conversation and information. If you would like to learn more about this podcast, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next week.